This episode of the Change Happens podcast covers a discussion on the effects of mental illness and suicide. If you or someone you know needs support or help with mental health or suicide, please talk to a GP, a health professional, or if in Australia, contact Lifeline 24 hours a day on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. Or at lifeline.org.au. That's lifeline.org.au. Change happens. How we respond to change can make or break us and our careers. Join us for an intimate insight into how senior business leaders face change, the good, the bad, and everything in between. Because whether we like it or not, change happens.
Hi, my name's Janelle McMaster, and I'm the Managing Partner of Markets at EY Oceania. This podcast series, Change Happens, is a conversation with senior business leaders on leading through change and the lessons learned along the way. When we set out creating a podcast about how we cope, deal, and work through change, we didn't expect it to be amid the biggest worldwide change in modern history, COVID-19. During COVID-19, isolation is something that all of us are facing in one form or another. As people undergo personal crisis and adjust to the new reality of life in lockdown, including personal and economic implications, there's the grim reality of a likely increase in mental health needs and a very real threat of an increase in the number of suicides. Our guest today is John Brogdon, CEO of Lancom, focusing on providing social and economic benefits to the people of New South Wales, and also a chairman of Lifeline Australia, a national charity providing all Australians experiencing a personal crisis with access to 24-hour crisis support. John has walked a very public journey of success, failure, and redemption. From being the youngest ever leader of a major political party in Australia at 33, to a very public suicide attempt, which marked the end of his political career, to a clear recognition of success as a chairman and CEO, John has truly embodied the highs and lows of a very public life. Welcome to Change Happens. How are you going during this time? You know, think about all the things that are happening now. It's got to be an extraordinary time to be the chair of an organisation like Lifeline.
Well, I guess my life's divided into three categories at the moment. Family would be the first one. My wife, Lucy, and I have three children, 16, 14, and 12, and we're all in the house almost full time. So that's a change. And I know lots of people are wondering when they're going to strangle their children. But from our perspective, with a bit of tension from time to time, it's actually been a lovely time to spend this close time with our children. Of course, the other role is as Chief Executive Officer of Lancom. We're a land developer in New South Wales. We're a New South Wales government state-owned corporation. And for us, we're 180 staff. Thankfully, we had tested just the week before the move to working from home our emergency system, our crisis team, and that worked well. So we've been relatively calm and simple in transferring our staff to working from home, and we've been surveying our staff regularly, and they're very positive about the systems and how they're working and interacting with other staff. So that's a very good start to this what could be a six-month period. And then Lifeline is probably the most interesting and intellectually challenging area of work at the moment. Our volunteers, we have 2,500 volunteers on the phones across the country, and staff, paid staff as well. Our model is that they go into the office and do their work. So, of course, most of our staff over 70, and more particularly volunteers over 70, have just stopped coming in. We've had some pressure on our volunteers as a consequence of that. But the flip side of the coin is we're finding, because people are at home, because they have more time, we've actually seen an increase in volunteer hours, and we've also put more paid staff on. So at Lifeline, we are receiving the greatest number of calls in our 57-year history.
That's a bit of a segue to the next question I was going to ask you around that demand, because the background to this podcast and you being a guest on this podcast was, it came about actually after I attended the launch of your Bushfire 13 helpline at Lifeline, which was in mid-February. And I remember at that event, you talked about the devastation on communities with the fires, the demand on mental health workers, is the need for establishing that 24/7 helpline. And at that time, we really saw that the country coming together around that. Certainly none of us in the room that day would have predicted that a month later, much of the world would find itself in lockdown the way it has. So I was actually wondering about the surge in demand. Like, it was already high around the bushfires. What are you seeing now with the pandemic and what that has meant for the nature of support that's being called upon from Lifeline?
So Lifeline usually receives 2,500 calls a day. Just to reflect on that, they're from Australians in crisis and at high risk of suicide. About 30% of those are suicidal calls. And 10 to 15 in numbers, not percentage, 10 to 15 of those calls every day, our crisis supporter makes an assessment that the person on the other end of the line is at such high risk of suicide that we keep them on the line and tag the line to the police and ambulance, who send a police and a police car and ambulance to where that person is. So that's our day-to-day, if you like. What we've seen from December 2019 with the bushfires is an increase of 300 to 400 a day, let's say 2,900 a day. And we're now reaching numbers as high as 3,200 a day during the coronavirus pandemic. So we've seen a massive increase year on year, an extraordinary increase, March to March, April to April, if you like. Thankfully, we've been able to not only answer those calls, but increase our call answer rate because of more paid services and more volunteers. But the overwhelming majority of people talking to us are talking about corona in one way or another, and talking about the stress and pressure that's putting on them.
It feels like a bit of a double-edged sword as I listen to those staggering numbers. On the one hand, I feel incredibly gratified that people do reach out and lean on the support of an organisation like Lifeline. On the other hand, I feel terribly, you know, saddened by this increased need. How do you view that? I mean, what's the critical success factors, I guess, of Lifeline? Do you see that as a positive thing that it's gone up, or a, you know, a negative thing?
Well, I like to say I'd like to be the chairman of an organisation I can shut down one day because we don't need it anymore. Wouldn't it be great if we didn't need Lifeline? But we've needed Lifeline since we started in 1963, and our demand has only grown year on year. Yes, you're right. It is a double-edged sword. It's fantastic people are reaching out. People shouldn't suffer in silence. They shouldn't feel that their problem is too big or too small to talk to somebody about. But at the same time, it does demonstrate the levels of stress. And what we're finding probably are two themes. The first thing is, whilst it's important for us to socially distance at the moment and to self-isolate and to lock ourselves down, whilst that's good for our physical health, it is not good at all for many people's mental health. So if you already have a very small social circle, maybe not many people in your family, you live alone and you're already susceptible to loneliness, this would exacerbate that situation. If you can't leave your home or can't leave it very often, you may obviously be worried about your health and other sorts of things. So we've seen an increase in loneliness. And the second thing we've seen is an increase in anxiety. And it's not just from people who are already anxious, who already have clinical anxiety. It's also from people who've never had an issue before in their life. And what I've noticed with my friends and family and the like is people who usually sail through tough times and you would never think would be affected by a tough situation. Many of those people have found this incredibly stressful. They're worried about their health, their family's health. They're worried about, you know, yes, there's money to keep people going, but may not be as much as you used to earn, your mortgage is under stress, on and on the list goes. There's only one salary in the house now, there used to be two, whatever it might be. So people are becoming quite anxious, and we're seeing a lot of that anxiety come through. The other thing is, and we're talking in April at the beginning of all of this, I mean, we're a month in, if this does last 6 months or longer, then we think the longer this lasts, the more calls we'll get because the worse this will become. I mean, the novelty is well and truly over. But as we move into winter and as we move into, you know, the sun, the days are shorter, I think we'll find people finding more stress and pressure come upon them.
I mean, look, I think that what you've outlined is very real, certainly very disheartening, but I think we've got to face into some of those realities that may be upon us. And I guess I'm interested in that comment that you've made around the increase in anxiety, and it is brand new for some. You know, a number of people would have never had these feelings before. And I know, John, when you've talked about your own, you know, history with mental health and mental illness, that you have said one of the saving graces that you have had is your heightened sense of self-awareness, that strong sense of self-awareness. And I'm wondering, particularly for those who this is a new space for them, what you learned in developing self-awareness that others might be able to be hyper-attuned to.
Well, if you'd asked me, John, are you self-aware about 20 years ago before I had a suicide attempt, I would have said to you, what's all that Buddhist bullshit you're talking about? You know, for me, I would have thought, what do you mean self-awareness? You know, well, I don't understand what that is. And of course, I'm in control of myself. And of course, I'm under control would probably have been my interpretation of what you were saying. But for me, it took a suicide attempt and it took many years of understanding my mental health to come to terms with my self-awareness. And for me, it means any number of things. In particular, with dealing with my depression, I have depression and I have suicidal ideation. That means I have clinical depression, probably a mild to medium form of it. And I have suicidal ideation, which means if things go badly for me, I run a high risk of catastrophizing those things and then thinking very quickly about suicide as a way of dealing with the situation I'm in. So that's what I live with every day. So I've learned to do a number of things. I've learned not to go into situations that I find too stressful. That includes family situations, personal situations, not to talk to people I know who will make me distressed or upset. And that was hard because we're taught from a young age to be nice to people, to socialise. Most of us are taught you've got to do that. You've got to go to this person's party. You've got to go to this event. You've got to go to this person's home. And it becomes very much ingrained with us. And, of course, we've also got to be nice to people. So I find that the best way for me to deal with stressful situations is to not engage them, literally not to do them anymore. And we're very used to doing things because we think we have to. And that's the culture and the familial arrangements I grew up in. And I've had to learn not to do those things. I also manage my stress better with more sleep, with exercise, and they're very important to me. I happen to also be on medication. I'm on a mood stabilizer and an antidepressant. I take medication every day of my life, and I have done for the last 14 years or so. And lastly, I see a psychiatrist on a regular basis. So there are a number of things that make me self-aware. I'm self-aware enough to know that if I go to a certain environment, it will make me too stressed and too distressed. That took a long time. And I had a relapse of my mental health, mental illness, should I say, just a couple of years ago when I had to effectively go back into hospital for a week or two. So I know the other thing I have to do is not get too busy, not say yes to too many things. So learning to say no was very important for me.
And I think what I'm hearing in that, John, is what you've done is given yourself a lot of permission to say no to things, permission to not engage in those things that you have identified maybe triggers for you. And the other part of what I'm hearing in there as well is, and I know that you've been quite a public advocate for not allowing shame to creep in. So I guess de-shaming isn't a word, but I'm going to use it for right now. De-shaming and giving yourself permission in order to help yourself survive and thrive. It seems to be paramount in there.
I'm very, very much of the view that you don't ask for mental illness. You don't go looking for it. It usually visits upon you, and in most cases, it'll visit upon you through circumstances over which you had no control, particularly in areas like childhood. And you should not be ashamed to have a mental illness. There is no shame in having mental illness. And I talk about it openly, and I must say I find it, interestingly, not mentally draining, but quite physically draining to tell my story in great detail. But I think it's important because we hear a lot about people with bipolar syndrome. We hear a lot with people on high-profile sporting figures and the like who have depression. But we don't hear from a lot of people who talk about the journey I've walked, which is right down into suicide and coming out the other end. So, I mean, I thank God every day that I did not complete my suicide. The thing is, we mostly hear that somebody has taken their own life and that's the end of the story, and we mourn that. But what people need to understand is there is a light. You can come through this, and there are people who love you, and there are systems that will help you to get through this very difficult time. So we need to hear more talk about people who get to that darkest point of their life, which is suicide, and how they're able to bring themselves back out the other end. And that was a hard journey for me. I'm not trying to make it sound easy, but it is important that people hear that journey. It's also very important, and this is particularly in a business setting. I think the last stand for bad attitudes towards mental illness are in the workplace. And you think of it, you think of your own workplace where people have a physical illness. Well, you know, we let them take months off. We support them through their cancer. We bring them back to work. We know what to do without blinking. Sure, we have an HR manual that tells us what to do, but we don't even have to open that up because we want to help that person get through their cancer, whatever their physical illness may be. Mental illness, we still have a negative view. We still have ignorant view, to be honest, and we still worry a lot about whether that person could ever come back to the workplace and do the job they used to do. So I think one of the best things, along with all of the wellbeing programs that many people are adopting, is for somebody senior in a workplace to talk about their mental health, to talk about how they may have had mental illness and how they've come through the other side, because that effectively says to people in that organisation, if he or she, a senior partner, a manager, a general manager in this organisation or the CEO can have a mental illness and live with it and work here, that means I can work here and that means I have nothing to be embarrassed or ashamed about.
Mm, that's great. And I mean, that's no small thanks to people like yourselves who've been so publicly strong advocates for raising awareness and telling difficult, sharing personal experiences like yours. Are there also other things that employers and leaders can do, particularly now, which is a really new environment we find ourselves in, where people might not even be identifying that they have an issue? Employers might not be aware of it because it's never been one before. Yeah. So I guess what I'm trying to understand as well is what leaders can do now in a changed environment where some of them, the cases might not be the ones that were apparent to them, and that there's some hypervigilance that's going to be required in this environment. What's your advice to leaders now with these new conditions we're facing?
Indeed, many people are no longer able to sort of just wander down the hallway and see how somebody's going because that's everybody's right. Working at home. It's just, it really is a case of staying in touch with your people and training your managers to understand what some of the triggers are. So, for instance, if you look at something like depression is something of a sustained change in behaviour over a four-week or longer period. So if somebody goes from, you know, we all have bad days, so sometimes you get in late, you have a bad day, your boss gives you a grilling and, you know, you sort of fall back into your usual pattern. But if as a manager you're noticing a significant shift in somebody's behaviour, that is a real sign that something is changing. You need to be more vigilant now than before because you don't have that, many people aren't having that physical interaction. And obviously, people will be under different sorts of pressure. I mean, you know, four people around a kitchen table, you know, two working and two doing schoolwork, you know, there's only so long that that's fun and that becomes very stressful.
The novelty wears off pretty quickly.
Very quickly. So I think it is hypervigilance. I think it's looking for changes in behaviour. And frankly, I think it's asking. This is a time where every manager should be asking their reports, how are you going? How, you know, and the next step, you know, is everything okay? How are you finding the workload? And is everything all right at home? Now, some people will find those hard questions to ask, the personal questions, because it's just not in their nature to ask them. But it is about, as you said, hypervigilance, and it's about going the extra mile to ask people how they're going and drill down and ask those questions. Many will obviously feel uncomfortable and won't tell you the truth. There could be some cultural barriers to that as well. But others will let you know, and then you're in a position where you can help.
So, John, this podcast, you might have noticed, is called Change Happens. So it's a podcast around change rather than crises. You know, we've talked a lot about mental health crisis, bushfire crisis, pandemic crisis. They're obviously related, crises and change, but the latter... Well, crisis certainly has a more negative and detrimental overtone to it. Maybe if I bring this back up to a change topic, what's your attitude and approach to change? And maybe if you could share some of the lessons that you've learned in dealing with and leading through change that you've picked up over the course of your work and life situations.
Well, it's bloody hard. I mean, to be honest, I've had more bad experiences trying to make change than good experiences. The older I get, the wiser I get, the more mistakes I make, I think I get better at it. But, you know, and having been a politician, you think I'd get this, but we used to have an old rule in politics that the minute you're sick of saying it is the minute the public are hearing it for the first time. So you cannot communicate enough. You cannot communicate enough. It's not possible to communicate enough, and you have to resist. What often happens is people will come to you and say, look, we've already said that three times. Why are you saying that again? And the answer is because about a third of that group weren't listening. So we need, you know, they've got something happening at home, or they've got a deadline they've got to meet, or they've got to pick up their kid from school. They're not listening. They're not listening. You've got to keep banging away at those messages. So, and you've also got to create the reason you're doing something, and hopefully, therefore, the change makes sense. And I think you have to be honest. And the hardest part about honesty is, if particularly if you're doing a restructure that may involve people losing their jobs or having significant changes to their roles, which can be very distressing for people, particularly if they're very set in their ways and at the point in their life where they want to be left alone to do their job, and they don't live to work, they work to live. You know, it's a very different arrangement. So I think you really have to be able to tie it all together. They're my lessons with change. And I guess the other great lesson is some people move on very quickly. So a week after you've made the change, some people have just literally changed gears and they're fine. But a lot of people find it quite traumatic. Mm. And you have to be very empathetic and sympathetic to that. Now, it can't last forever. You can't have somebody a year later still moping around that they're not happy. But you do have to keep working through the change. Change can be unifying times.
And I think that's a reason why people will say the phrase, don't waste a crisis. Because if there's something that I have seen that's happening right now, as unfortunate as the situation is, there is massive amounts of change in areas that we did not think it was possible. You know, if you think about consultants who rely on travel as a key part of the way that we work, you think about the boundaries that have evaporated between unions and government and employers, you think about all sorts of things that people were never able to drive before, but because of the crisis, they're all being changed. I think this is an opportunity for us to reflect on what's happening now in this crisis, how we're responding to change, and what does that mean about the way we change moving forward, so our approach to change moving forward that we can capture?
Well, we had a very informal, flexible working policy in my organisation. We formalised it last year. People thought, isn't flexibility all about flexibility? Why is there a policy about flexibility? So it was interesting. We did have to put it. Yes, very ironic. But we had a lot of, and they were older people who just didn't like the fact that people went at their desk every day. Now those people have no choice, and I'm on teleconferences and video conferences with them several times a day, and they have switched seamlessly.
Amazing.
The one thing, as good as video and audio conferencing is, the one thing I think we have to work out how we replace in this world is the chat you have bumping into somebody in the hallway. Mm,
the incidentals.
That's gone.
That's right.
Yeah. One of the real rules of leadership that I believe in is being present, you know, being seen, being there. And, you know, that may only be 10 minutes out of 8 or 9 hours you're in the office, but it's 10 very valuable minutes.
Yeah.
How do you do
visible
that?
Visible accessibility, isn't it?
Correct.
Yeah, that's right.
How do I do that in this environment? You know, do I just ring staff out of the blue and say, how's it all going? You know, maybe I do, but we need to work out how to do that. I think the other real thing we need in change, and I think this is part of leadership as well, is it's good to have a bit of humour along the way.
Well, I do think, you know, there's no shortage of memes that are going around and have been for the last couple of months that people, I do think it brings levity to a situation that it can be incredibly tough. And I think there's something about laughing about shared experiences, shared adversity does make a situation infinitely better. So, John, just, you know, in your role as CEO of Lancome, since you mentioned it, you know, obviously, affordable housing and urban planning is very much at the core of why Lancome exists. And if you think about the loss of housing through fires, the displacement that's been caused, and now we've got financial pressures in housing and home loans and renting, tell me about how that's affecting Lancome, your role as CEO, and the kinds of conversations that you're having around how Lancome can support in this environment.
Well, I'm 51 and I've lived in Sydney all my life, and the thing I'm least proud about Sydney is we are the second most expensive place in the world to buy a home. Behind Hong Kong, or I think it's Vancouver, depending on which time and which poll you're looking at. So that's extraordinary. That means we are an inaccessible city to so many people as a consequence. So we need more affordable housing in Sydney. So there's, and in Australia, there are two things that, you know, you can have proper designated affordable housing, or housing can be more affordable through any number of things. And during that same period I mentioned, over the last 40, 50 years, we've also changed radically in the way we live. I mean, the people I'm thinking of, I always like to try and provide people with a picture in their mind of who we need to look after. We need to look after people who work in retail who don't earn high incomes. We need to look after people who work in restaurants who often don't get high incomes, particularly if they're casual workers and part-time. We need to look after the people who push trolleys in hospitals and push mops in hospitals. They need places to live. And what's happening now, by and large, is one of three things. They are living in an hour and a half or 2 hours from where they work. That's one way. So, you know, 3 and 4 hours a day travelling. They are paying an enormous amount of their income on private rent, much more than they should. Or lastly, they're renting overcrowded houses. And this is not well known, I think, in our major cities. But, you know, you can rent half a room in major cities in Australia in a three-bedroom apartment for an enormous amount of money. I mean, there's no quality of life in any of that. So one of the many areas we see a growing disparity in wealth in Australia is in people's housing situation. And we're very passionate about looking at the capacity to do more affordable housing. It is extraordinary, isn't it, when you think that a city like Sydney is more expensive to live in than places like New York, which have billionaires to boot, and London and other places.
It's unfathomable to me. Yeah.
It is. It is. And it's not too late to try and turn it. But I'll tell you what, it is a major issue. And how does it manifest itself? Well, you know, how are you going to employ people to pour coffees in the middle of a CBD if they've got to travel 3 hours every day to do that job? So there's an enormous amount of work going on in planning. Other countries get it right. A lot of it's mandated, to be honest. A lot of, if you go to a city like London, there's a lot of mandated affordable housing in big developments. So they do mandate it. Maybe that's part of the challenge we have to embrace here to make sure people have somewhere decent to live. But at the moment, we have too many people who are just never going to get off the treadmill of high rent or crowded living or massive commutes every day. And that's not good for people's longer-term mental health.
Do you think, again, sort of this whole not wanting to waste a crisis, I guess, do you think that there may be changes that might impact urban planning and housing in the longer term that will come about as a result of what we find ourselves in now?
Possibly. I think...
Maybe that's me projecting some wishful thinking?
No, well, it's interesting. You know, we develop property, and mostly we develop land and sell that to people as a generalisation of what we do. So we're obviously working out what our future looks like, you know, during and post this pandemic. But the one thing we're coming to realise, you know, through all of the international economic organisations that are making commentary right at the moment, is we're heavily likely to head into a recession when we come out the other end of this. That'll rebalance the country enormously and put more housing stress yet again on people. When all this ends, there won't be a switch that's flicked. Everybody won't go the next day back to the job they had six months ago. It just won't happen that way. So people will lose their houses during a recession. People will lose their jobs. They'll lose their houses. So the pressure to do affordability will increase, not just because of the pandemic, but of the recession that will follow.
John, so none of us know what's going to happen in the future. I think none of us really know what's going to happen tomorrow at this stage of the game. With your experience as a leader in many platforms dealing with the unexpected, what sort of predictions do you have for society and business for the next, you know, 5 years?
Well, the first thing I confidently predict, there will be a number of people confidently predicting the future over the next 6 months. I think there'll be an industry and people saying things will never be the same, things will never be the same. So, look, I think you're right. I mean, you'd be a brave person to guess what it is going to look like. I just think things are going to be tougher. We're going to have a reality check. They make movies about what we're living about in the moment. I mean, the extraordinary ones have zombies and the like, but put that aside, they make horror movies about pandemics, wiping out cities, wiping out populations and all that sort of stuff. Australia's probably one of the world leaders right now in how we're dealing with the finances and the health issues related to this pandemic. I think future-proofing and flexibility will be really important. So will this see people change their spending habits? You know, we have a whole economy that needs people to spend to grow. Will people say, no, I'm saving more money now? If this happens again, I need to have tens of thousands of dollars in the bank to get through it because the government won't be able to pay my wage next time. So I think people will be more cautious and people will save more money and the economy will not grow in the way it's grown in the past. I think the other thing is there will be a massive debate about more manufacturing in Australia. And I think we will see different forms of economic growth and a greater level of caution, particularly individual caution. Businesses may not be as cautious, but people will be very cautious into their future.
Thanks, John. Look, I absolutely agree.
The last three. Three fast questions on change to finish the podcast.
So, last three for you. What's a misconception that most people have about you?
Wow. That I'm a liberal as opposed to a progressive liberal. Okay. People would just put me in a box as a liberal rather than a progressive liberal.
Okay, well, there you go. People are going to hear it here first, maybe. one guilty pleasure. Do you like to keep it PG, please?
Chocolate.
Chocolate. And what's one thing that you're absolutely hopeless at?
Wow, cricket.
Cricket?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I can share
shocking.
That with you.
Shocking.
I don't have an interest in it, so it doesn't bother me too much. But
I was never successful in politics, that I wasn't able to be a cricket person.
Well, look, thanks for your time, John. I really appreciate how candid you are. I think anyone listening to this podcast would agree that you've been incredibly candid, incredibly passionate, that you've talked about massive changes to the way we live, the way we work. And, you know, a few takeaways for me is there is a difference between mental health and physical health, but we should be treating them with as much, if not more, awareness and importance, particularly in the times that we find ourselves in now. I've taken away the criticality of self-awareness in this and the role that we as individuals have in being aware of our own triggers and circumstances that may not be good for us as individuals. And then thirdly, the role of leaders here to stay hypervigilant, to stay engaged with people, particularly where we move into remote working situations where ease of walking down the corridor, as you say, might not be as available to us as it might have been in the past. So look for changes in behaviour, ask the questions, and go the extra mile. So they've been some of my key takeaways, John, and I really want to thank you for your time and your openness with me today.
Oh, that's very nice, and thank you for the opportunity.
The Change Happens podcast from EY, a conversation on leading through change. Discover more where you get your podcasts. This episode of the Change Happens podcast covered a discussion on the effects of mental illness and suicide. If you or someone you know needs support or help with mental health or suicide, please talk to a GP, a health professional, or if in Australia, contact Lifeline 24 hours a day on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. Or at lifeline.org.au. That's lifeline.org.au.